Activist: How to Balance Business and Values in Architecture. Hi, my name is Marcin Wojciech Żebrowski, and welcome to the newest episode of Urbcast, my podcast about urbanism, architecture, cities, and many more. I am very excited to be here after a short summer break and come back with the new episodes of this podcast. Especially that Copenhagen got extremely inspiring recently, especially during the summer. UNESCO, the United Nations Organization for Education, Culture, Communication and Science, together with the International Union of Architects, have designated Copenhagen as the World Capital of Architecture 2023. And as a result, the UIA World Congress happened here in Copenhagen in July. More than 6,000 participants from 135 countries, 150 sessions, 250 science papers, and 400 speakers came together in Copenhagen, all with one goal: sustainable future, leave no one behind. Niasha Harper-Michon was one of them. She is an architect, business strategist, educator and writer. She coined the term archivist to describe architects driving positive change in society and the profession. Interestingly, she also works as business developer at UN Studio, an architectural design office based in the Netherlands. She has written for various publications and is involved in projects focused on sustainability, inclusion and technology in cities and architecture. She is very passionate about promoting the health and well-being of people, place, and the planet. Niasha was a keynote speaker at the UAI World Congress, and we met at Henning Larsen office to discuss Niasha's balance between being an activist, but also a business developer. In our discussion, we explore the concept of activism and the potential drive to the positive changes in the industry, but also we talk about some difficulties and challenges, especially the ones met by young architects starting their careers. We share some guidelines and some help for the young designers and students, and also talk about how can we connect business and values in the architecture. Because Niasha, whereas she is advocating for more equality and diversity and sustainability in the industry, she's also working as the person selling the services of an architecture office, as this is something that I'm doing myself as a business developer at the Henning Larsen office. I was really curious about how can we connect those two, and I think that we managed to cover this topic in a very, very interesting way. So welcome to the newest episode that I'm very, very excited to present to you together with Niasha Harper-Michon. Without further ado, I just wanted to say, Niasha, welcome to Urbcast. I'm so happy to have you here.
Yeah, I'm super glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me to chat with you.
I appreciate it because your time here in Copenhagen, it was a pretty busy time. You've been there at the World Architecture Congress, a huge, huge event happening here in Copenhagen with a lot of discussion around architecture, urban development, cities. And you have your own message, your own agenda that you also presented here in Copenhagen. But maybe before that, as this kind of a discussion opener, I would like to ask about your background and how did you happen to be the archivist?
My background is in architecture. I studied and worked as an architect in both Paris and in Amsterdam, where I live now. And just getting involved in the architecture world, I started to feel like the industry was a bit insular, let's say, or a bit slow to change, slow to catch on to some of the advances of some of the other industries, for example. And there's a lot of issues that we're dealing with. I mean, we all know, the climate crisis, biodiversity loss, rampant social inequality, urbanization. There's a lot of topics that we're dealing with in the world today. And I felt that within the architecture industry, we weren't addressing them enough. So either in my schooling, I felt that these topics weren't really looked at in detail, let's say, and even on the job when I was started working, I felt that we could be doing a lot more. So I just started getting involved in work that could, you know, have impact in these different areas. And with that, with time, Arctivism was born. And I think it's, in a sense, it's, we have a lot of issues that we're dealing with in the world. Yes. And it feels like there isn't one technical solution, let's say, but I feel that Arctivism is maybe a bit a soft solution, let's say. And the idea is that it's the blend of architecture and activism. Ideally, I would love for all architects to feel that they can be Arctivists and that they can feel empowered to bring about change, and beyond architects as well, other industry stakeholders or even enthusiasts, people who aren't trained professionally in the sector, but who want to bring about change. So,
how much time did it take you to find out that actually you want to do something more than just designing? And I mean here, I thought that we will discuss about it a bit later on in the discussion, but let's discuss the challenges that especially young people have while starting in the architecture industry, because I feel like there is this disconnect between what you study and what you experience when you start working. And it can be the long working hours or the overwhelm of work or hierarchical structures in some of the offices. So how did you navigate around those and found that there is this thing that you want to fight for?
I think it starts with a bit finding out who you are truly. I found this drawing that I had done when I was younger and like really, really young. And it's this, like there's two ladies sitting on a chair or something in a house. And it says, I wish that all the poor people were in a house. And then it says, and food. So in terms of syntax, I was not very good. But I think that it kind of shows that long before I wanted to be an architect, I was always interested in doing good and taking care of people, especially those that are the most vulnerable or people who really need additional support. And so for me, that's where it all starts. And then I wanted to be an architect in the sense that I, when I was younger, I played with my older sister. We made a town in our basement, and it was just, little houses and schools and everything that you need in a city. And we made them out of, you know, cardboard boxes and juice cartons and anything that we could find. We were really resourceful in that sense. And my mom was like, yeah, you know, actually this might be architecture. So I went to an architecture camp when I was like 11. And yeah, the task was basically to do what I was doing when I was younger. So I was like, oh, well, okay, I want to be an architect. But being an architect is, let's say, a profession, but it's a vehicle to do something. And I think that in the end, it's more about what you want to do. And then afterwards, your profession, in a sense, is the means. It's not the end. And sometimes with architecture, it feels a bit like that it's the end. It's not the means to get somewhere, but it's seen a bit as the end all be all, that designing is the thing. But I think it's more about the impact that you create through design. And so that's one thing. I think starting off is a bit thinking about what impact it is that you want to make. What sort of things do you want to do beyond the profession that you'll have? So thinking about that and getting a bit in tune with what that might be. And that's a journey in itself. I think sometimes people put a lot of pressure on themselves to be like, I need to find my purpose or whatnot, especially young people nowadays. But I think that that's something that can be a lot more organic or can evolve with time. You can have many passions, many purposes. There's not a something that you find once or something. So to relieve a bit the pressure, and then to address a bit what you were saying about the disconnect between school and work. I think that happens also in other fields as well, that the theory part somehow doesn't translate into the reality of work. And I think that's because sometimes in schools we focus on the practical aspects or the technical aspects of the job, but working is also about working with other people. Our profession is one where we work with lots of different stakeholders, engineers, the client can be developer or in a public sector, city officials or whatnot, and loads of other consultants that are needed to be able to create a building. So that's already one thing that's, you know, it's about being able to understand the perspectives of others, but all working on one project, so finding common ground, which are not always skills that we learn in school. So you kind of have to learn that on the job. So it can be a bit of a shock sometimes to do that. And then, of course, like you said, there's entering the culture of architecture, of architecture offices, and how that works. And sometimes there is a bit a disconnect there. But I would argue that the schools also kind of set up in that way where I barely know an architecture student who hasn't pulled an all-nighter, who doesn't feel that that there's always more, that you can always, you know, continue with the project, that you... So I think that culture is also starts in architecture school, and I think that it needs to change in architecture school. And sometimes it goes into practice, because everyone in practice has been to architecture school, so we have that way of thinking that you should always push more hours, stay late, that it's never finished, that you can always make it better. And in a way, this perfectionism, I can understand from a creative perspective, you always think, well, it could always, you know, do it a little more, right? Yes. I mean, I think we all can relate to this. 1% more. Yeah. But after a while, it's not healthy. And I think that that's something that we're dealing with within the profession, but also in the school system, because in education and architecture as well, I think burnout is also happening there, which is really terrible, that in the schools, even before you enter practice, you're already drained and feeling sometimes inadequate, or that your ideas are not valuable enough, and that you should just push yourself and work harder, which I don't think is the way that we should work. It's not a healthy way, so it doesn't lead to, in the end, good design, in the sense that you're just overworking yourself. So we have a lot of work to do, both in practice but in schools as well, to change that culture that we have in the architecture world.
We have this saying at Henning Larsson that the best idea always wins, no matter if you are a senior or you are an intern. It's just important what do you bring and what's your perspective and idea. And of course, it is saying a lot about this Danish democracy, but I don't think it's like this in all of the places around the world. And talking also about the mental health of the profession and fighting for oneself. And here the archivist role comes in again. How did you find the kind of strength and room for being this kind of an advocate for the values you have, for the social equality, but not only? I think that this discussion about how can one fight for oneself in terms of the health, the mental health especially, is such a great advice one can get when he or she starts in the industry. So my question would be, yes, about structuring your thoughts around developing archivists' approach and maybe some challenges around that. Yeah. People always like to hear about challenges.
This developed for me really as something that I felt was important for me. So I took time sometimes outside of the work or the job, let's say, or school, to develop these ideas. But one of the things that's really nice, I think, with today's day and age is that we have social media. So I think that really brings people together. Of course, well, there's a whole discussion on social media and how it also doesn't bring people together.
Yes.
But okay, let's, for the purposes of this discussion, in the sense that you can really reach out to a lot of people of all different levels of experience within the profession, or also in professions that are like tangential to the architecture profession. So that's also nice. And what's good with that, and I did this, is that you're able to, yeah, meet people who are also working on these themes and who have been working on them for many years, or people who are just thinking about them now. And you start to create also a network, which can also be a support system, because I think what you're alluding to with the mental health issue, but also with tackling all of these big, wicked problems that we're dealing with, is that sometimes it can feel a bit lonely, or you can feel, you know, how do I do all of this? How can I solve all of this and also have a job and take care of my family and do all these other things?
And have some fun.
Have some fun. Have a social life. Very important. So I think that creating a support system through just reaching out to people and finding people who think like you, also people who don't, and also being confronted with your own ways of thinking and questioning that, like you said, about cultural things, like some cultures might have systems where it's more of a flat hierarchy system. And then the way that the architectural process or design process is that everyone has the opportunity to participate. Maybe in other spaces, it isn't so. And because of that, it can be that you don't feel that you can participate yourself, even though the space might be allowing you to, but because of where you're from or what your past is, that's not what you've learned to do. I think that there's a lot of that when we work in international context. There's people with different cultures that feel that there's things that they should and should not do. So it can be interesting to be confronted with different people by just reaching out to people across the world. I mean, that's what's good with social media. You go on LinkedIn and you can talk to someone who's miles away, but who's also dealing with some of the same issues that you are, and you can create a bond that way. And then the second part with social media is you can also start to challenge things and talk about things through that platform. And that's what I did mainly. I felt that some of these topics needed to be addressed also in ways that were easy to understand or digestible, because some of these topics are very big. And sometimes it can feel either like, oh yeah, we know, or it can be something that's hard to grasp. So trying to distill that and think of ways of making it visual, for example, for us visual people like architects, or trying to bring it down to concepts that are very easy to understand is also a nice way through social media to make things quick and snappy that people can be like, huh, that's an interesting thought, just on their way to work. And maybe it can have a bit of an impact on them and also create a connection with someone who you didn't know before, but through content you meet. So
speaking up would be
that first tool. Speaking up and reaching out to others, I think creating that network, I think really helps and can be a lovely way to also discover more about yourself. Mm. So I would advise that. And we have the tools. So just use them as you wish, you know?
The tools are there, definitely. And I think this is a very good advice and a first step. How can one start expressing themselves? Because I think that this is also what you do a lot if we discuss unfolding activism, right? And the other thing I really wanted to discuss is that maybe it's not enough emphasized that in architecture, you can do many different things. And even if someone is trained as an architect, they can work, for example, with communications or with clients, with business development. And I would love that to be the second part of our discussion, because you are also working as a business developer. And let's explain that in a second. I'm happy to be working as a business developer as well, but previously I was trained as an urban designer, and I also have those struggles trying to find myself and the best use of my skills, which were mostly about like talking to people. I love talking to people, hence the podcast as well. But in that case, I would wonder how can one achieve this balance between advancing the business side of what we do, the business interests, but also staying true to your values. And that was an interesting part when I was preparing for this discussion and looking at what you do, is how do you preserve those kind of two hats? Is there such a division for the two hats that one is trying to advocate for this, for basically empowering people, and the other hand side is the numbers, is the finance, is the money part of the equation?
To be honest, I think it's a bit of a misconception in architecture that business is bad or something. I feel like there's this idea that, the term marketing is like a dirty word. Mm. Sales, don't even mention it. And it's, to me, it's a bit strange. I think these words are quite neutral. I mean, you can do things badly or you can do things well. I don't think of it as being something that's opposed to values. I believe that you can run a business, a for-profit business, and still do good. I don't think that these two things are polar opposites. If not, I think that would be a real shame. I mean, I think there's lots of companies that are doing great things and also, running a successful business or practice. So I think why I got into business development is also similar to you in the sense that I wasn't a big fan of sitting behind my computer all day and, you know, drafting things. It's something that's very important, but not my forte, not something that I love to do. Hmm. I much prefer talking with people, engaging with people, trying to understand their different needs and trying to bridge different needs and trying to get the best out of the situation. And also a big part of it was being at the forefront of an architectural project. So one of the things that I always found, funny, let's say, when I was working at the beginning, was that we would often have colleagues who were complaining about the projects that we were doing or complaining about the clients we were working with. And I always felt like, well, yeah, then why are we doing this project? Or why don't we do another project? And there was a bit this idea that, well, yeah, this is just how it is. So it's a bit annoying, we'll complain about it, but there's nothing really that we can do. I beg to differ. And so getting into business development was getting to the first stage, being able to seek out the types of clients that can make a difference, the types of businesses or developers, investors or cities that are really looking to make a difference in any way. It can be, you know, pushing the envelope in terms of circular economy or trying to build really inclusive mixed neighborhoods. There's a myriad of things that people are advocating for. And I think that having the opportunity to seek out these people and to make those connections, make those partnerships is really a great way to be able to have the right projects. So it starts with making those good connections with those right people, but also seeking out which types of projects you should and should not do. Working on a strategic level to think, how, if we do want to make an impact in terms of sustainability, making a regenerative future, then who should we be working with? What types of projects should we be working on? Also, if we're working with clients that might be more traditional or a bit more conservative on some things, how can we use our knowledge to convince them to push the limits of their way of thinking and to also change something there? Because sometimes you're working with clients that are completely all in, and that's so great when they really want to make that change. Sometimes you're working with clients that are a bit less, that you really have to convince, let's say. But sometimes that's also really nice projects because the curve from the beginning to what the actual result is huge. And then the transformation is even bigger, that you know that afterwards they are even taking it on and, you know, being like, this was our idea from the start. I always think that that's a wonderful thing. It's not about, you know, no, this was our idea or whatever. It's great when a client is more than happy to take it on and say, you know, this was our ambition from the beginning to do this. Sure, good. We achieved something. We've changed their mindset, and at least the next time they'll be more open. So I think the business development isn't polar opposite of having values or something. I think it's tying them together and using it as a vehicle to be able to get in projects that can have impact. So seeking out the right partners, seeking out the right projects to be able to make even more change at the beginning, and to change the brief, to plug in the right things at the beginning when you can, because later on in the project things start to be quite set. And there's less room to be able to make change.
So that was introduction in a nutshell to business development in architecture. And I think it's important to talk about that, because when I was trying to transition to business development, I really couldn't find much information about what that's actually those people do, how one gets a project, how the projects that you say that your colleagues were complaining about, how do they end up being the projects? I think that's a very big part of the task, for a big part of the job of a business developer. So I would love to develop that thought a bit more and focus on the language we use in advocating for good projects. Mm-hmm. Because my problem sometimes is that it was also, I think, that at the World Architecture Conference now, that they are architects talking to architects. So you often have this situation that you have a panel discussion and a lot of people, like all the panelists, they agree and then they leave. And then, okay, so what's the next step? So here, especially focusing on the clients or on cities, on municipalities, what language should we use to make them aligned, and how can they find value in what we do, and how can they think about the more regenerative future, especially the ones that are maybe more traditional ones, mm-hmm. and think more about the profit first?
I think you raise a really good point of language. I would say it starts with empathy. And I think that that's an important aspect for the way that we design, but it's also an important aspect of how we work. I say empathy because it's also about understanding who you have in front of you. So when you have a client, indeed, in the architecture profession, we tend to see things from the architect's perspective, which is normal. I mean, we are architects. But then sometimes that's where it ends. And we have a bit of trouble understanding the other side or what the motives are. Or we see it in a bit of a negative connotation. So we tend to have judgment on it and say, oh, they're just trying to make money here, or they're just doing, you know. But we are the good ones who want to make a good world just because we're just good, you know?
And pro bono.
Yeah, exactly, right? And they're just trying to make money and they're greedy. But that's oversimplification of things, and most of the time it's not true. So I think it starts with empathy, trying to understand the needs and speak the language, like you're saying, this idea of language. Speak the same language as those who are paying for the project, those who are, yeah, commissioning it, because at the end of the day, they are putting money down to make this building. You know, we are being paid for the service of designing for it, but we don't actually invest. If the building doesn't come out, if we're paid for our hours, I mean, we're still paid for our hours, right? If the building doesn't happen in the end, they've invested a lot of money and they're not going to get it back. So
yes.
The stakes are different, right? And I think that just understanding who you have in, across the table is a big part of it, and being able to speak their language. So sometimes it's also about not describing our projects just in the architectural features. Like, I read a lot of things on Arc Daily or Design, where it's very architectural in the way that it's in the way that a project is described, which is maybe good for Arc Daily because it's for other architects. But if you're trying to discuss the same project for a party that's going to operate the building, then they may want to hear about different things than just what it looks like or what these materials are and how it's so nice for well-being. And they might want to have a translation of what that means for some of the things that they're dealing with or on the day-to-day. So I think that that really helps. So equating things sometimes to numbers, so speaking in things that people can really pinpoint, which can be hard, especially on the social aspects. I think in terms of environmental, so when we think of ESG, so environment, everything that's social, and then governance, the E, everything to do with energy is quantifiable. So it's quite simple to understand, like if you're operating a building that uses less energy, the impact is clear. You know, you spend less money on operating this building, so you're saving a lot of money. Clear, right? Clear. But when it comes to things that are a bit more about well-being, sometimes it's a bit harder to pinpoint. But using language or the same metrics, for example, that the client might be looking at is usually something that helps. So in an office building, it can be about talent. So bringing talent in, so keeping people working in this company and not leaving because they're like, wow, it's such a great building to work in. And it also reflects the values of this company, for example. But also sick leave. We know that like buildings can really affect the amount of time that you might take off being sick, which absenteeism is a big cost for a company. So those kinds of things can be really good ways of talking about something where architecturally it's one thing, but then after the effect is another. So those are just some examples, but I think that usually helps in explaining how an architectural feature affects some kind of metric or some kind of situation that is important to the client. And it can be, you know, also, for example, working well with participation, having a good track record of working with communities to be able to get a project, yeah, out of the ground in a way where the community is not going to be pushing back against it, that there's not going to be a lot of extending of the building process because, or of the permit process, because, you know, there's a lot of complaining or these kinds of things, which is, you know, time is money. So just those kinds of things can be yet another reason that that a developer might go for a certain design or a certain process, because they know that, well, they need to get the project out of the ground at such and such date. And through the, you know, the architecture firm's track record of working well with the community and engaging with the community, we're able to get the project out of the ground. And from an architectural perspective, it's great because you're able to work with the community and get these aspects, the social aspects of the project, really in there. But then how you communicate it to the person who might be paying for it maybe is slightly different than how you would just communicate it to other architects. So it's always a bit balancing between your needs and what you want to get out of it, the agenda that you're pushing as an architect, and then trying to convince someone who maybe has a different agenda and trying to bridge that with using a language that meets them where they're at. And I think that's, yeah, empathy is a big part of that. Mm.
I think that we should create a dictionary around this, because I think that this is still a pretty unexplored land, and and you shed a light on the importance of the empathy. And this is something that also was very important to me when I was starting to basically talk to people and listen. I think that listening is such an important thing.
Yeah.
That's why I tend to speak less than my guests in the podcast. And I think that the listeners also appreciate it. I always try to think from the listener's perspective. And I know that a lot of young people are listening to this podcast, a lot of students, or maybe people starting in the industry of urban design, architecture, but not only. So to wrap it up, I would like to ask you for some kind of a recommendation. So what would you say to people who are going through studies, through education, and they are trying to find themselves in the industry? I know that we've been discussing about it a bit in the beginning of this conversation, but yes, what would be like this one advice that you could share with the listeners so that they can advocate for what they want to become?
I would say that going beyond architecting as usual, so thinking of expanding the notion of what it means to be an architect, would be the first thing. I think Arctivism is all about that there's many ways to be an architect. And you also mentioned, you know, there's other avenues aside from designing as an architect. There's so many other ways to still be an architect or an Arctivist. So also to not put pressure on yourself or think there's only one path. I think to open up your ideas of what you can do beyond your education or beyond the professional roles that you have, that there's many options in architecture. There's business development, there's working in communications, but there's also working with some of the other consultants that we work with. So working on the engineering side or in landscape architecture or in sustainability consulting could be, or working from the developer side. There's so many things in the built environment that I think an architectural education and background can be a good jumping board or springboard into a variety of different professions. So also to not put pressure on oneself to think there's only one path. So yeah, to not to expand the definition of what it means to be an architect, to embrace different things, to use a bit the 21st century way of learning yourself. So being a bit the master of your own education. So of course there's things that you learn in school, but there's YouTube, there's social media, there's books. Also just read, do things that are interesting to you. Like I said, reach out to people, talk to people, and you start to shape a bit your voice as an architect, because sometimes at the beginning, it's also, who am I as an architect? Yeah. What does that mean to me? And I think it can mean something very different to each person. So just go on a journey of looking for that. I think sometimes, yeah, it feels like that we should have a map, like that, you know, the destination is being an architect, maybe being a licensed architect, you know, registered architect, so you can sign your own work. But I'm really more like have a have a compass, more about your values and purposes and all the things that you're passionate about, and use that as a way to navigate your career more than thinking that there's one finality that is being a registered architect. That could be where your compass takes you. That's perfectly fine. But it could also be somewhere else. And to explore that, sometimes directly in the job that you're working on, sometimes the job that you're working in doesn't allow that flexibility. So then, you know, just have discussions with other people, use a bit, don't use all your spare time. That's not the message. Don't be burnt out or something. But just take some time to explore and learn who you are and meet new people, read and expand your notion of architecture and the built environment. And I think with time, you start to be more confident in who you are as an architect, what your values are, what you want to do, what you don't want to do, what you want to work on, what you don't want to work on. And you feel more empowered also to make those choices and to stand by them.
Such a map, I think it would be too easy. You've mentioned that it would be good to have this map and point A, B, and C, and then just look at the map and follow the path. But
that's not life, right?
That's not life. No. That's about discovering the map.
But sometimes it feels like that this is how life, or how in architecture school you're a bit taught that there is a map, you know, that this is your path. This is what you do. You do your bachelor's, you do the master's, you work in an office, whatever. Then you start your own practice. Then there's a bit this path or this thing that you're supposed to do. Being a good architect is having your own office and, you know, maybe winning a Pritzker in the future. But I think that there's so much more that is going to be the path for some people, but it doesn't have to be your ambition as a young person or even not a young person in the profession. And I think it's nice to realize that there's so many other things that you can do, or you can work within a larger practice and be super happy there. You can start your own little studio. You can work in a nonprofit that deals with the built environment and sustainability. I mean, there's so many different things. And I think that's more the message, to be open to many paths and not fall into the trap of the ABC points on this map.
That's right, exactly. We are not showing the map. We are just giving some hints and tips. And the last one is, I would love to ask you for a book recommendation, one book that would be also inspiring to the listeners.
Yeah, a book that I really love, and I read it and was mind blown, is Invisible Women, Exposing Data Bias in a World Designed for Men, a book by Caroline Criado Perez. And it's a book that explains a bit how our world has been designed for men, and it doesn't leave a lot of room for women, but also other identities. And it exposes things within the built environment, but also not within the built environment. But it's very eye-opening, and I think that it's important as designers, you know, we shape the built environment, which is a space that everyone in the world uses. It's not just for a certain group. And in general, it's been designed for what I call reference men, which is your 1.80 meters tall, cisgender, heterosexual, able-bodied, upper-middle-class white man. But most people aren't this guy, you know, and it leaves out a lot of people, children, elderly, LGBTQ+, women, people of color, people with disabilities, people who are neurodiverse. It leaves out a lot of people, and it just creates a world that most people can't really fit into. And so thinking beyond this reference man is extremely important, I think, in design. It leads to much better design as well. And in this book, you get a good feel for all the different things that are designed for this guy, or for like the modular man, Le Corbusier, or the Vitruvian man, as we know him in architecture school. And it's very eye-opening to see what that means, that the world is sometimes, a lot more dangerous or inaccessible to certain groups. And I think that reading this book can be a very good way of thinking about inclusive design, and definitely having a starting point that ditches reference man and that comes with a much more open approach, and you realize the biases that we all have, and that we then, you know, get into into the way that we design, and that the result is then very exclusive a lot of the time. So that's my book recommendation. Really good read. One of my favorites.
Perfect. Niasha, thank you very much for this recommendation. But yeah, I mean, especially for this whole conversation, I hope that we've managed to inspire the listeners around the world, actually more than 70 countries, actually. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This was a lovely conversation.
Thank you for listening to the newest conversation together with Niasha. And I hope that you got as inspired as I was during recording this conversation with Niasha. I think that there are many different ways of pursuing a career in the architecture industry. And Niasha proved that, yeah, you really need to stay consistent and work for your dreams. And there is no one model that fits all the situations. So please feel free to reach out to people that inspire you within the industry. You can also reach out to Niasha. You can also reach out to me and talk about how can we make this world, this architectural world, at least a bit better. You will find the useful links to the things that we've discussed in this episode description. And I talk to you soon in English in 2 weeks.